Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me today. In the last several episodes, we've discussed the political history of the Roman Empire in the 5th century, the period that, in the classical formulation, witnessed the disintegration of the structures and institutions that had held the empire together. What replaced the Roman Empire as a political unit was a series of successor kingdoms, barbarian kingdoms, that set up shop in what had once been the provinces of the empire. The Anglo-Saxons carved up Britain, the Franks, Burgundians, and Visigoths took Gaul, the Suaves, and then eventually the Visigoths, took Spain, and the Vandals occupied North Africa, and eventually the Ostrogoths took Italy. Last time, we discussed the Visigoths, the first barbarian group to transform themselves from a mobile army into an incipient kingdom around the city of Toulouse in southwestern Gaul. Today, we'll discuss their Gothic cousins, the Ostrogoths, who took a much different path in establishing themselves as the rulers of Italy. There was to be no hostile sack of Rome at the hands of the Ostrogoths, unlike the Visigoths. Instead, the Ostrogoths were happy to present themselves as the defenders of Rome. The great Ostrogothic king Theodoric and his successors ruled from Ravenna, much as the emperors had. They had an administrative system directly adapted from that of the imperial court. They collected taxes, appointed officials, paid an army, repaired infrastructure, dealt with the Senate, corresponded with the Pope, maintained diplomatic relations with the other barbarian kingdoms, and at least in theory, operated as the willing subordinates of the Eastern Emperor in Constantinople. We have an extraordinary collection of documents produced by the Ostrogothic administration, a collection unique in its time and for centuries afterward, and it's to these documents that we owe this deep impression of Romanness, of business as usual. In sum, the kingdom of the Ostrogoths appears, for all intents and purposes, to be a minor transformation of the Roman Empire rather than a marked break with the past. This might seem surprising to us. The Ostrogoths were relatively recent migrants to the Roman Empire, refugees from the breakup of Attila's Hunnic Empire in the aftermath of his death, and yet it was the Ostrogoths who established this most Roman of barbarian kingdoms. Where the Ostrogoths came from, what kind of state they built in Italy, and how that state met its end at the hands of the conquering armies of the Eastern Empire will be the story that we explore here today. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. The Ostrogothic kingdom presents us with a series of paradoxes. Under its first and greatest king, Theodoric, it was easily the most powerful and prestigious of the new states that emerged in the barbarian West, but it lasted just over 60 years before disappearing completely. The Ostrogoths were recent arrivals within the Roman Empire, but of all the barbarian kingdoms, it was they who built the most self-consciously Roman state, one that gloried in its celebration of Rome and its glorious past. Some historians have even argued that the Ostrogoths, specifically that first and greatest king Theodoric, presented themselves as the continuation of the Roman Empire. That is an argument that I find incredibly convincing, and it's one that we'll talk about a lot more over the course of today's episode. For the Roman aristocrats of Italy, who had been at the core of an empire that had stretched over the entirety of the known world, the events of the 5th century weren't easy for them to come to terms with. These people weren't idiots. They understood that they were being ruled by incompetence, that huge chunks of territory that had formerly belonged to the empire were slipping from its grasp, that barbarian outsiders now ruled where provincial governors of good Roman stock had once exercised control. This wasn't just the loss of an empire. It was a blow at the self-image of the Roman aristocracy, one built on the idea of eternal empire and the self-evident superiority of Roman civilization, which they felt they embodied as aristocrats. When the Ostrogoths showed up in Italy, a conquering army led by a powerful, impressive king with a deep understanding of Roman culture, these Italian aristocrats jumped at the chance to restore their sense of themselves through an alliance with these new arrivals. But let's take a step back here. Who exactly were these Ostrogoths, and where did they come from? As with the other barbarians we've discussed over the course of this show, that question is maybe a little more complicated than it appears at first glance. Like those other barbarian groups, the Ostrogoths weren't a homogeneous ethnic group bound together since time immemorial. Instead, they were a relatively recent agglomeration, a diverse collection, one that had come into being in the cauldron of Attila's empire and the aftermath of its breakup after his death. So let's travel back in time a little bit here. When the Huns arrived on the western end of the Great Eurasian Steppe in the early 370s, they encountered the Goths, who, at that point, were the dominant force in what was probably a diverse, loosely connected kind of political space that stretched from the Carpathians to the Don River, basically from central Romania to the eastern Ukraine. Within this realm, Goth was probably as much a political label as an ethnic one. The Goths were the most powerful people here, and the Gothic language was probably just the most common in a region where you might have heard a dozen different tongues. Now, when they arrived, the Huns defeated the Goths. Some of these Goths fled into the Roman Empire in 376. These were the ones who beat the Romans at the Battle of Adrianople and, through a long process of becoming, eventually became the Visigoths, as did less celebrated others in the next couple of decades. Not all the Goths fled, though. A lot of them, probably most of them, stayed behind, and the Huns may even have relocated tens of thousands of them en masse from north of the Black Sea to the Danube Basin, near the Roman border. Within the new Hunnic Empire that sprang up, and you might want to go back to and re-listen to episode 9 on this topic if you want a refresher, or if you haven't already, within that political unit, the Goths were an important part. Now, the main theme of our episode on the Huns was that their empire was far more organized and internally coherent than it has long appeared to historians looking at it from what amounts to the Roman perspective. It was a steppe empire, a form of organization with long roots on the Great Eurasian grasslands. The fact that its structures and institutions were much different than those of the settled empires of Rome and Persia doesn't mean that those structures and institutions didn't exist. When we look at the Hunnic Empire as a steppe empire rather than something it fundamentally wasn't, meaning like a settled empire, then all of a sudden, its dominance and sudden rise to power start to make a whole lot more sense. We don't have to turn to overwrought appeals to vastly superior Hunnic horse archery or pure nomadic savagery to explain the Hun success. They excelled at recruiting, organizing and supplying military forces, and at the gathering of strategic military intelligence, and they built the structures necessary to ensure that they got what they needed. The Ostrogoths were one of the major groups subject to the Huns, one of the most numerous and one of the most important. The Gothic language was something like the lingua franca of the Hunnic Empire. In return, the Goths living under Hunnic rule were unequivocally influenced by Hunnic cultural practices, including artificial cranial deformation, the practice of elongating the skull of an infant. It's also probable that these Goths received a Hunnic ruling elite, which took on Gothic names in order to better fit in with their new subjects. Intermarriage among Gothic nobles and Huns was likely common. This is kind of a major part of how steppe empires integrate their subject peoples, by taking control at the very top and then exercising loose control over their subjects. When the Hunnic Empire broke up in the aftermath of Attila's death in 453, that's when we first really start to hear about the group of Goths who would go on to become the Ostrogoths. They fought on the losing side at the Battle of the Nadau in 454, where Attila's sons were defeated by a loose coalition of former subject peoples, including the Gepids, Heruli, Rugians, and Scyri. It's more likely that this was a battle between the Hunnic elites who ruled these subject groups than one of ethnic independence from the Hunnic yoke, though. In any case, the Ostrogoths weren't the winners here. And in the aftermath of the battle, they petitioned for entry into the Roman Empire, as the other Goths had done some 80 years before in 376. It was around this time, or just before, that the group that would go on to become the Ostrogoths came under the rule of a family called the Amals. Now, some historians place an enormous amount of emphasis on this family, and in their telling, the Amals had ruled the Goths for a long time beforehand, not just since the 450s. In this particular telling of the story, It was this Amal family who embodied all the traditions of the tribe. They represented the kernel of Gothic tradition, things like songs, oral history, language, dress, a sense of what it meant to be Gothic. Around them, a diverse collection of people, no matter what their background, could be gathered and kind of seeded with ethnic Gothicness. It's sort of a top-down view of how ethnicity is supposed to work. This is called the ethnogenesis school, and it's associated with an Austrian historian named Hedwig Wolfram and his many, very well-funded, I might add, students. This is kind of plausible, and a number of historians have found it pretty convincing. I'm not really sold on the importance of the Amals in all this, though. I tend to think ethnicity in this period, barbarian ethnicity, was a little more fluid, a little more tied to professional identity. These labels may be a little less meaningful than we might assume, and that our written sources for this period aren't capable of fully capturing the diversity of these groups or the lived experience of being Gothic or what have you. More importantly, though, I think these historians are reading way, way too much backwards from sources written in the 510s or the 520s, when the Ostrogothic ruling family in Italy suddenly got really invested in promoting itself for reasons that we'll talk about a little later. Basically, I think these historians are buying too easily into what was basically propaganda written for very specific purposes at a very specific and much later time. Their conception of what the Ostrogoths were, though, depends really heavily on this family having been important for a really long time, hence the emphasis. Now, there was a really deep, nasty, and not especially interesting scholarly debate about all this in the 90s and the 2000s, so if you want to know more, I can recommend some stuff to you and you can go knock yourself out. At any rate, though, that's a less important observation than that by the mid-450s, when this group of Goths entered the Roman Empire, they had a ruling family that would later make much of its importance and claim a deep lineage. The Goths, led by the Amals, and they were at this point, soon to become the Ostrogoths, weren't the only group of Goths that departed from the ruins of the Hunnic Empire around this time. They were one of just several that would play an important role in the politics of the Eastern Empire over the next 30 or so years. The sources are limited and confusing, and it's important not to read too much into them. We can only really be certain of the following: that the Goths had some kind of kingdom in what had been the provinces of Pannonia between roughly 456 and 473, that they were at least technically in the employ of the Eastern Empire as federate troops, as allied troops, that they received some kind of financial support, and that they seem to have done a pretty decent job of defending the frontier from the other former refugees from Attila's empire. The Ostrogoths left this post in 473, and they were soon to come under the rule of a young man, probably in his early 20s at this point, named Theodoric. This Theodoric is going to be the central character of our story today. He belonged to the Amal family. He was the son of a fellow named Theudemir and the nephew of Vitimer, the two previous rulers of this group of Goths. Now Theodoric, and this is important for our story, had spent his youth as a hostage in Constantinople as a guarantee for the good behavior of the group of Goths led by his father and uncle. In Constantinople, Theodoric learned to speak Greek and Latin, and he immersed himself in the ways of the imperial court. Now, in the last episode on the Visigoths, I pointed out that it wasn't the initial group of barbarian migrants who created these new kingdoms in Roman territory. It was the first generation migrants, the ones who had grown up in the Roman world, who both wanted to and knew what it took to create new political units on Roman soil. Essentially, these first generation migrants understood the rules of the Roman political game and how to play them. None of the barbarian kings better exemplifies this than Theodoric. He cut his teeth in the complicated world of high imperial politics between 473, when the Ostrogoths left the frontier, and 488. In those 15 years, Theodoric played the game like a master. After his Goths settled down in the Balkans in what's now Macedonia, Theodoric was initially confronted with a powerful foe, another Gothic leader named, confusingly enough, Theodoric Strabo. The Eastern Emperor Zeno did a great job of pitting these two Theodorics against each other, and our friend Theodoric the Amal, had to learn a bunch of hard lessons about military defeat and negotiation, when to fight and when to talk. Out of these various confrontations, it was Theodoric Strabo, not our friend Theodoric, who emerged victorious, building a substantial army and power base that became a legitimate threat to the Emperor Zeno himself. Zeno even went so far as to call in a group of Bulgars, probably a Hunnic group, from beyond the Danube to try to deal with Theodoric Strabo, but even that wasn't sufficient. In the end, it was only an accident that prevented our friend Theodoric from becoming nothing more than a footnote in history. If the story is to be believed, Theodoric Strabo fell off his horse and impaled himself on a spear at some point between 481 and 483, dying accidentally after working so hard to build himself into the apparent generalissimo of the Eastern Empire. Our friend Theodoric had bided his time, surviving, waiting, watching, and now he pounced. The Emperor Zeno gave him honors and encouraged him to take command of Theodoric Strabo's forces, which he did by murdering Strabo's useless son, Recitash. Zeno put this new combined Gothic army to use in a campaign in Asia Minor, but in the aftermath, our friend Theodoric, from here on out the only one, decided he wanted a better deal. He ravaged the Balkans and threatened Constantinople, but he couldn't take the city, and he and Zeno seemed to be at an impasse. The two sides in 488 hit on an inspired solution to this ongoing problem. Rather than sticking around and threatening Constantinople every couple of years in a fruitless pursuit of negotiating leverage, Theodoric agreed to leave the East and head for Italy. At this point, Italy was ruled by the general Odoacer, that same Odoacer who had deposed Romulus Augustulus in 476 and thus finally brought the line of Western emperors to an end. Since then, Odoacer had ruled Italy by himself, though at least in theory he had permission to do so from the Eastern Emperor Zeno. This permission was what allowed Zeno to send Theodoric and his Goths to Italy. In effect, he was revoking the regency over Italy that Odoacer had held, which gave Theodoric free rein to do his thing. On August 30th, 489, Theodoric's Goths met Odoacer's army at a bridge over the Isonzo River, where the Italian and Austro-Hungarian armies would fight a series of bloody and pointless battles in the First World War. Theodoric thrashed Odoacer, but it would take him another 3.5 years before he could shut Odoacer up in Ravenna and launch a siege of the capital city. Finally, in March of 493, Theodoric negotiated successfully with the city's bishop and entered Ravenna peacefully. At a banquet 10 days later, Theodoric toasted the old general Odoacer, then in his 60s. After the toast, Theodoric killed Odoacer personally. He sliced him nearly in half with his sword. "The man has no bones in his body," Theodoric said, according to a 7th century chronicler. With that act, Theodoric was the sole ruling power in Italy. Now in his early 40s, he would rule for another 30 years. It's to the kingdom he built that we'll turn next.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Now, at this point, the murder of Odo Walker and the foundation of Theodoric's new kingdom in Italy is where things really start to get interesting. We don't actually know that all that much about the first 15 years or so of his rule, though this must have been the period when he settled his troops in Italy and established his administration in Ravenna. Building ties with the Italian aristocracy would have been essential, and all indications are that Theodoric was extraordinarily successful at doing this. There's some debate about what Theodoric's relationship with Zeno and the Eastern Empire was actually supposed to be now that he was in Italy. We have a good handle on what Odoacer's had been. He was just the generalissimo and patrician, a legal status, who was ruling Italy in place of the emperor, first the deposed Julius Nepos, who had died in 480, and then for Zeno in the east. After Nepos' death, Odoacer had sent the imperial regalia back to Constantinople, signaling that he was keeping on with the arrangement. Zeno was the legitimate emperor, and Odoacer was, at least constitutionally speaking, just ruling for him. Now, despite his recent conflicts with Zeno and the imperial court, Theodoric had become a Roman general in the 480s, one with a large and powerful army. He had been showered with honors and official positions. He had senatorial rank. He'd been acting as Magister Militum Praesentalis, the leading general in the Balkans. From this perspective, Theodoric was a known, if potentially dangerous, quantity to Zeno and the Eastern imperial court. Theodoric had closer ties to them, much closer, than Odoacer did. Theodoric would be much less likely to make trouble on the Balkan frontier, as Odoacer had done in recent years. In effect, Zeno could replace a potentially dangerous neighbor with one who had good reason to be more friendly. Precisely what the arrangement between Zeno and Theodoric was supposed to be is hard to suss out. I'm convinced here by the arguments of a fine young historian named Jonathan Arnold, who wrote a really excellent book on Theodoric's Italy that I'll be drawing on a great deal in today's discussion. Essentially, Arnold's position on this is that Theodoric was dispatched to Italy to rule as a patrician and in his capacity as Magister Militum Praesentalis. He wasn't supposed to be a king, just ruling for Zeno. The Latin verb in the primary source is praeregnare, to rule in place of, or in lieu of, or something like that, up until the point when Zeno came to Italy to claim his rightful territory as emperor. Now, in practice, that was probably just a convenient fiction. Zeno probably never intended to actually come to Italy or to exercise any real control. But it has to be noted, this also gave the Eastern Empire a potential out in case Theodoric proved difficult. Zeno could simply send another army, led by another ambitious general with ties to the Eastern court, and revoke Theodoric's rulership in his name. Zeno, though, died in 491, and Theodoric's campaign didn't end until 493, at which point he had made some sort of deal with Odoacer that may have thrown a wrench into whatever his initial agreement with Zeno had been. Moreover, after defeating Odoacer, the Goths seem to have declared Theodoric a king in his own right, which was a definite breach of whatever he and Zeno had agreed back in 488. Naturally, this created a bit of awkwardness in the relationship between Theodoric and the new emperor, Anastasius, that took a few years to work out. In 497, years of back-and-forth negotiation finally produced a new agreement between the two sides, though the details of this aren't immediately obvious to us. One really important thing does stand out, though. Anastasius sent the Western Imperial Regalia, the things that Odoacer had sent east in 480, the crown and the scepter and all that jazz, he sent it to Theodoric in Italy. This was a hugely important act. Theodoric didn't ask for them, didn't want them, just so that he could keep them locked up in a broom closet in the palace in Ravenna. They were intended to be worn and displayed. What do you think the Western Imperial Regalia, things that had literally been worn by the emperors in the West, were supposed to say to an audience of Italian aristocrats and bureaucrats? If this is the correct reading of the circumstances under which Theodoric and the Goths came to Italy and established themselves in the early years of the new regime, and I think it is, that helps to explain the warm reception that they received from the Italian aristocracy. According to this line of argumentation, Theodoric presented himself not as a Gothic king or as a barbarian general, but as the new emperor in the West. The intended audience of Italian aristocrats, exactly the people that Theodoric and the Ostrogoths would need to win over to make their new state in Italy viable, bought this wholeheartedly. This would have been a pretty radically new state of affairs. A first-generation immigrant and barbarian general, whose immediate ancestors had been the leaders of Hunnic subject peoples, would now be sitting on the throne in Ravenna, be occupying the spot once held by bluebloods like Honorius, Valentinian III, Majorian, and all their predecessors in the more distant past. But Roman aristocrats, and this had always kind of been their genius, could buy the radically new if it came cloaked in the appearances of the past. Theodoric and his associates would prove to be geniuses at doing just this. Take this example from the Variae, the administrative letters written by an Italian aristocrat named Cassiodorus that I mentioned earlier. Here's one written in the name of Theodoric, written by Cassiodorus, one of these Italian aristocrats, to the Senate in Rome, which hadn't been relevant in centuries, but it was still composed of wealthy, powerful, and above all self-important aristocrats. Quote, "I welcome dedication to the public service, fathers of the Senate, since, while proving the commendable spirit of the citizens, I find the opportunity to confer well-merited favors. For what is so like a senator as to devote zeal to the public service that he may profit the country in which he is born?" End quote. This must have been music to the Senate's ears. Theodoric here is affirming their historic role and their present importance, while at the same time offering them direct rewards. It's like an idealized version of the relationship between aristocrats and ruler. It's everything these aristocrats could want. It's brilliant how perfectly tailored this is to the Senate's self-image and its desires. Again, this is Jonathan Arnold's argument, and I mostly buy it, with a few caveats that I'll mention here as we move along. Wrapping the new regime in the language of the past and projecting the image of the empire restored is something fundamentally different than what we might expect when we think of these successor kingdoms, what we've been calling the barbarian kingdoms. Now, there are a number of historians who would probably say that Arnold has pushed this just a bit too far, and I can see where they're coming from with that. Arnold's argument is fundamentally one that focuses on propaganda and perception, on ideology and expectation, rather than the reality of lived experience, on more concrete issues, or even necessarily how people responded to this. Moreover, in making Theodoric a Roman emperor, we kind of lose sight of the Goths and the fact that Theodoric was also a Gothic king. Those facts get subsumed and buried, and there's a lot of truth to the old idea that this was, in fact, a Gothic king with a Gothic army ruling Italy. I think those are fair critiques, but on balance, I'd say Arnold's perspective makes a heck of a lot of sense. This was a Roman world, full of Romans, and Theodoric had been thoroughly Romanized during his time in Constantinople as a youth. The Goths, who had been, at this point, in Roman territory for more than 30 years by the time they headed to Italy, they were effectively a Roman army, albeit one with barbarian overtones. In a lot of meaningful ways, these barbarian kingdoms were just drops in an already full Roman bucket. And when we overemphasize the barbarians, we forget the inherent Romanness of this world, of its people, and of its institutions. In that context, it made sense for Theodoric to give the Italians exactly what they wanted, an emperor they could simply slot into their existing mental frameworks and structures of how the world was supposed to work. Now, that same kind of criticism has been lobbed at my other favorite book on Ostrogothic Italy by a guy named Patrick Amory, who wrote one fantastic book, People and Identity in Ostrogothic Italy, and then left academia for a career in the music industry. Props to him for that. Anyway, Amory's argument, one with which I agree wholeheartedly, is that this new Ostrogothic regime developed a full-blast ideological campaign to get the Italians used to the Gothic presence and vice versa. This ideology can be summed up in one word that shows up over and over and over again in official and semi-official stuff coming out of the Ostrogothic court. Civilitas. Now, civilitas already had a long history as a propaganda term, one that was basically thought of as a virtue of the emperor. There again, we can see Theodoric reinforcing this idea of himself as an imperial figure. So what in the world does civilitas mean? We might translate it as civility or politeness, or something like good governance even, but that misses the more complex associations the word had acquired by this point. Basically, in Amory's telling, civilitas was a philosophical attempt to impose the proper relationship between Goths and Romans within Italy, two nations living at peace with each other, but holding fundamentally different and complementary functions within the state. This was propagated directly by Theodoric and by his advisors from the very beginning of his reign, and we have to see this as the product of his and the Goths' long exposure to Roman political, military, and even legal culture. This is all pretty abstract, though. What did it mean in practice? Basically, it meant that in this conception of the world, the Goths were soldiers and the Romans were civilians. Sounds simple enough, right? Sure, but it has enormous implications for the way Italian society was supposed to function and how people thought of their roles within it. Now, this builds on a lot of the stuff that we've already talked about in this show, especially the blurring of the lines between soldiers and barbarians. The Ostrogothic regime in Italy took this all to its logical conclusion with what Amory calls, quote, an ethnographic ideology. Basically, this was an ideology of mutual coexistence between the formerly mobile Gothic army, one that was separated by appearance, language, religious belief, the Goths were Arian Christians rather than Orthodox Christians, and the people of Italy, who held different ideas about those things. I'll quote Amory on this for a summation of what this meant. Quote, in its practical expression, this ideology implies that the Goths defend the Roman state, all inhabitants of which live under Roman law. Therefore, the army is composed of Goths, and the civilian population is composed of Romans, end quote. Now, this didn't just blur the lines between being a barbarian and being a soldier. It totally erased the distinction between the two. To be a barbarian, a Goth, in Theodoric's Italy, was to be a soldier, and to be a soldier was to be a barbarian, more specifically, a Goth. Not only did this ideology equate the two, it celebrated them and their military successes, leaving behind the more ambiguous relationship between soldiery and citizens that had characterized the late empire. This wasn't just an admission of the usefulness of barbarians. This was a full-throated acceptance, an embrace of barbarians. It created a positive social role for them, one for which they would be well paid through the allocation of tax shares. Civilitas, that one word that we talked about, was a useful shorthand for this entire system. Everything we know about this new state, whether we think of it more as a restored Roman Empire in the West or an Ostrogothic kingdom, suggests that it was basically a continuation of the late Roman state in terms of how it ran and how it functioned. As far as we can tell, they did a pretty good job. Through the Varii, those administrative letters written by Cassiodorus, a second, third generation bureaucrat, we can see the Ostrogothic regime draining swamps, maintaining the government post system, moving soldiers around, building fortifications, appointing competent officials, dealing with social conflicts and land disputes as they crop up, and handling other matters. In terms of foreign policy, Theodoric had a pretty interesting plan or series of plans. This is actually what I wrote my master's thesis on years ago when I was living in Ireland, and I stick by what my younger and less knowledgeable self mostly thought of these things. In fact, it actually accords pretty neatly with what Jonathan Arnold has argued much more convincingly in the recent past. In the early years of his reign, up until 507 or so, Theodoric presented himself as an imperial or a quasi-imperial figure to the other barbarian rulers in the West. He built relationships with these other rulers by means of dynastic marriages, marrying his daughters to the son of the Burgundian king, and the other one to Alaric II, the king of the Visigoths. His sister married the Vandal king. He himself married the sister of the Frankish king, Clovis. Now, there were other options available for marriage alliances, but Theodoric had chosen all of these kings because they all ruled provinces of the former Western Empire, and as the emperor, or something close to one, at least in his own mind, he wanted to find ways to rule them, to rule these other barbarian kingdoms. Once these relationships had been established by means of these marriages, Theodoric presented himself as the superior figure, as an emperor exercising rightful authority over his subordinates. The ties of kinship were the most important way of doing this. He talked about himself as the father of Alaric II and used the phrase, quote, kinship submits to itself, when trying to get Clovis not to attack Alaric II in 507. My favorite expression of Theodoric's supposed superiority in this community of barbarian kings is this, from a letter to the king of the Burgundians in 507. Quote, if any one of you does any wrong among yourselves, you sin deeply with my resentment. This was a pretty brilliant plan, one that would have matched externally the kind of imperial role Theodoric had publicized for himself within Italy. The problem was that it didn't work, and in a lot of ways, this is the story of the second half of Theodoric's rule. In 507, despite Theodoric's best efforts, his brother-in-law Clovis, king of the Franks, went to war with his son-in-law Alaric II, king of the Visigoths. This war ended with the death of Alaric II and a crushing defeat for the Visigoths, one that drove them out of Gaul and into Spain for good. The web of relationships that Theodoric had spun for himself had singularly failed, and his pretensions at playing emperor to the other barbarian kings were revealed as hollow fictions in the face of some pretty brutal realpolitik. Theodoric's foreign policy changed after this. It got harder and more realistic. And while the civilitas ideology and imperial pretensions would remain within Italy for a while, those two would eventually slip away in favor of something more, well, barbarian. In the aftermath of the events of 507, the Ostrogoths went to war. They captured Provence in southern Gaul. They dealt some stinging defeats to the faithless Burgundians, and they brought the Visigoths under their control, too. They fought against the Eastern Empire as well at this point, ending whatever pretense Theodoric had projected about ruling in place of the Eastern Emperor. These were short-lived conflicts, but they caused a major shift that took about a decade to fully repair. And in some ways, they had actually never repaired it. After this, there was more emphasis on the glorious military achievements of the Goths as a people. Perhaps thinking about a future without him, Theodoric at this point took pains to emphasize the glorious ancestry of his family, the Amals. This is when we start to see more of this. We know less about this period, though, because our friend Cassiodorus, the author of the Variae, this Italian bureaucrat and aristocrat, he wasn't working at this point, so we don't have those useful administrative documents. So we can't really see this shift happening in real time. From other sources, though, we get a sense of some of the problems that cropped up. The last years of Theodoric's reign saw conflicts with the Italian aristocracy, including the execution of the great Boethius, who wrote his incredible Consolation of Philosophy, a great work I'd recommend to absolutely anyone, while in Theodoric's prison. Even the Pope, John, died in prison after accusations that he'd been conspiring with the Eastern Emperor. Based on the correspondence, he probably had been. Now, a reign that had begun in triumph and built a creative, coherent regime in Italy out of the building blocks of the Roman past and a barbarian army, it was becoming something much different by the late years of Theodoric's reign. After Theodoric died in 526, it didn't take long for things to go downhill.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
It's not like things fell apart as soon as Theodoric died in 526, and I don't necessarily want to give you that impression. Theodoric was succeeded by a young man named Athalaric, his grandson, who was just 10 years old when he came to the throne. Athalaric's mother, Amalasuntha, ruled in his place, and she did a dang fine job of it. She maintained close relationships with the Eastern Imperial Court, and when the new Emperor Justinian sent an army to reconquer North Africa from the Vandals in 533, the Vandals who had ruled the region for more than a century, they used the Ostrogothic ports of Sicily as a base from which to attack Carthage. But to some extent, conflict was growing inevitable. Remember earlier how I talked about the nature of Theodoric's rulership and how he presented himself? He was ruling in place of the Eastern Emperor, perhaps as the Western Emperor or at least something close to it. Theodoric fit within an ideological framework that stressed connections to the past, even if to us it's obvious just how new and radically different the state of affairs really was. As Theodoric's reign went on, though, he had grown increasingly self-confident. All that talk of civilitas, of ruling for the Eastern Emperor, that was slowly being replaced by a self-perception that stressed the glory of Gothic arms and of the Gothic people, and the importance of the Amal family. The other elements were still present, though, and they fused in interesting ways with the more Roman-oriented talk of earlier in the reign. One letter of the Varii from this period refers to the, quote, purple dignity of the Amal blood, a clear reference to the imperial claims that Theodoric had made for more than 30 years. There we see both aspects intertwined, the dynastic claims of the family and the imperial propaganda, bound together in one really meaningful phrase. As long as Amalasuntha ruled for her son, things held together pretty well. As far as we can tell, she did an excellent job. She walked the fine line between maintaining close relationships with the Eastern Empire and the other barbarian kingdoms, while still enforcing Ostrogothic military supremacy in the Western Balkans and in Gaul. As far as we can tell, the Ostrogoths were still the most powerful of the successor states, and they acted like it, at least as long as Amalasuntha was still alive. So, if it wasn't Theodoric's death that led to the real decline of the Ostrogothic regime, what was it? Well, Theodoric's grandson Athalaric died in 534 after 8 years of rule, reportedly because he drank and debauched himself to death with the Gothic army. He was just 18 years old, and he'd never actually ruled in his own right at this point. His mother, that Amalasuntha, had been regent this whole time. When Athalaric died, Amalasuntha married a cousin, a powerful Gothic noble and big-time landowner named Theodahad, in an effort to maintain her position at the top. She chose poorly. Theodahad already had a bad reputation. Theodoric had had to rein him in when he tried to seize some land in Tuscany some 20 years earlier. But what he did next was even worse. He had Amalasuntha imprisoned and then murdered her, started to rule in his own right. Now recall that the Eastern Emperor Justinian had just sent an army to Africa, where it had made short work of the Vandal kingdom and reclaimed the region. Note what I said there, reclaimed. In the decade or so before the Vandal War in 533-534, the Eastern Empire had taken a much more aggressive ideological stance, one that was probably a response to the more self-confident affirmations of barbarian leaders like Theodoric and the Frankish king Clovis. In this new Eastern Imperial ideological program, official propaganda and things coming out of the imperial court, they were beginning to emphasize the idea that the West really had been lost, that the empire had actually fallen. This is right around the time when we really start to see that sentiment crop up. This was a big step. It meant that there was no longer a place for someone like Theodoric with the kind of imperial or at least quasi-imperial legitimacy that he'd worked so hard to build in the 490s and the 500s. That world was slipping away. And if we think about it, that makes sense. Anybody left who remembered the deposition of Romulus Augustulus would have been nearly 80 by the time Amalasuntha was murdered. Anybody old enough to have fought for Theodoric on that initial campaign in Italy would have been at least in his mid-60s. That whole generation, the one for whom the empire in the West was a recent rather than a distant memory, was dead or dying. When Theodahad murdered Amalasuntha, Justinian didn't waste the opportunity. If Theodoric had been legitimate, and his daughter a partner with whom the empire could work, her murderer had no genuine claim to rule Italy as a representative of the Eastern Empire. Even if that were a somewhat flimsy justification after nearly half a century of Ostrogothic rule, it was nevertheless a justification, and it's one that Justinian was happy to jump on. Justinian's great general Belisarius crossed over to Italy and captured Rome practically unopposed. The Goths were through with Theodahad's miserable leadership, and he was deposed and replaced by a new king, Vitiges, who shortly thereafter had Theodahad murdered in turn. Vitiges shut Belisarius and his troops up in Rome and besieged them there for more than a year before finally giving up and heading back out in 538. Both sides appealed to the Franks to enter the conflict, which they did by invading northern Italy and butchering both Goths and Romans alike. In 540, Belisarius stuck Vitiges and the Goths in Ravenna, where he seized the city, captured Vitiges, and sent him as a prisoner back to Constantinople. The war might have ended there, with the Ostrogoths defeated and fragmented, and the Eastern Empire fully in control of most of Italy, if not for the man who eventually took control of the Gothic throne in 541. This was a mysterious figure named Totila, who rose out of relative obscurity to take command of the Gothic armies and reverse most of the losses they'd suffered in the last 5 years. He retook Naples and Rome, then built a fleet and retook Sicily, Sardinia, and Corsica. He raided the Balkan coast on the opposite side of the Adriatic and thrashed Belisarius repeatedly. Finally, in 552, after 11 years of successful rule, Totila was finally killed in battle. His successor, Teia, and the remnants of the Gothic army went down fighting on the slopes of Mount Vesuvius later in 552. Aside from a few stubborn Ostrogothic holdouts, this Gothic war was effectively over, the Ostrogothic kingdom just a memory. Italy had been ravaged, and after a few more years, nobody in Italy would ever again call themselves a Goth. Now, the glory days of Theodoric's kingdom were a fond memory, though, even if a memory. Cassiodorus edited and published the Variae just as this Ostrogothic kingdom was crumbling into dust in the 550s. And if they show us the positive side of Theodoric's rule, that's because the longtime high government official and aristocrat Cassiodorus wanted his readers to see that side. This had been a time of peace, power, prosperity, one underpinned by a deeply appealing ideology and close cooperation between the Italian aristocracy and the newly arrived Gothic soldiery and their king. Some historians, especially a really smart guy by the name of Shane Bjornley, who recently wrote a fantastic book on Cassiodorus, would say that this fact makes the Variae basically unusable as sources for that earlier period. His point is well taken. The fact that Cassiodorus was fondly remembering the past when he picked and chose what went into the Variae is really deeply important. But just because Cassiodorus remembered it fondly doesn't mean there isn't some real truth to his portrayal. Looking back at the Ostrogothic kingdom from 554, or even from our perspective, it's easy to see what the Ostrogoths did as just a blip in the record, a failed experiment that went nowhere. Alternatively, we could do what a lot of historians have done and buy into their late propaganda about the long, glorious history of the Amal family and see the Goths as a glorious warrior group, as too many have done from the 16th century to today. But if we do that, we miss the real accomplishment of Theodoric and the regime that he built. A creative, unique attempt to do something radically different with the old building blocks. Theodoric himself emerges as one of the most compelling figures of this entire era. A barbarian prince who emerged out of the wreckage of the Hunnic Empire, a barbarian prince who became a Roman general, and then finally a king, or an emperor, who made his kingdom the Western Empire reborn. Next time, we'll be exploring another of these barbarian kingdoms, the Kingdom of the Franks, from whom we get the name of the country of France. these Roman allies expanded outward from the frontier to encompass the entirety of what had been the Gallic provinces, leaving behind a legacy of internecine conflict, intrigue, and some of the most compelling characters of the whole period. Thank you very much for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd really appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. And if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice. You can follow me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat a bit about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line. If you'd like to help me out even a little bit more, I'd really appreciate it if you took the survey at wondery.com/survey. That's wondery.com/survey. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.